please tell me your name and in what capacity you served in World War II?
I was drafted into the Army from Springfield, South Dakota. I was a student at Southern State Teachers College, and to meet the quota, bottom county had to meet a quota for draftees, so I was drafted out of college. At the time, there were about 52 students on the campus. Guess what? Five boys, and the rest are all girls. I got drafted, so that left four boys, and two of those did not pass their physicals to get into the service, so they continued with their training.
So there were two boys left with all those
The two
girls.
boys left it all. And I went to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and then I was assigned to Camp Walter, Texas, for my training, boot training, combat boot training. And after that, I was sent home on a furlough. And I went to Camp Howell, Texas, to prepare for overseas combat live training. And I boarded a ship at Camp Shanks, New York, USS Brooks, October 6th, and landed at Marseille, France, October 20th.
How old were you when you were drafted?
I was 18 when I was drafted, and my birth date is November 29th, as you were, November 23rd, and I was captured on November 29th, so I was 19 days, as you were, I was 19 years, 6 days before I was captured.
Do you remember how you felt when you got drafted?
Well, as you can tell, the enrollment at the college was five boys, and so really all my playmates and classmates had been drafted or volunteered. So, and I had an older brother in the service already, Jess H. Dawes, and he was in the Air Corps, had been home on furlough, and we visited often about his training, his days. So, I was ready to go because I didn't want to be left alone, I guess. But my parents thought, well, better go.
So you had one older brother in the service as well.
Yes, I had one brother, and I have a sister living now in Sioux Falls. Her name is Nina Janssen, Janssen. Her husband went through Africa, fought all the way up through Africa into France and Germany, but he's now deceased. He came home and went to college also in Springfield.
Do you know how your parents felt about they had the two sons then, you just had one brother, so both of their sons were over fighting. That was probably very common.
I tell you what, I was given a diary from graduation from high school in May. I'd been writing that diary, and then when I got ready to go to service, I took the diary with me. I thought, well, I'm going to write my diary while I'm in the service. But no way. When I got to Camp Chance, they would not allow such a thing to go overseas, which so I had to mail it home to my mom. And I really appreciated mom writing the diary while I was gone, gave me a lowdown of the events. But just think of her writing this diary, often said, "Child, child, where are you?" And maybe the two or three pages later, "Child, child, where are you?" And so it's amazing how the parents, you parents out there, just what you all went through to have your sons and daughters go to war.
So you arrived in Marseille, France, according to the information I have in front of me, and you said earlier, you were telling me earlier that you were a replacement. Tell me a little bit about being a replacement at this point in the war, being sent over to the European theater as a replacement.
As a replacement, you're not acquainted with anybody. Did not know one soul, one person. So do you have to go through the night and through the drills of combat soldiers, not knowing who your companion was at all. But after we got captured, then we started striking up a friendship. I recall one gentleman who was probably up in the upper 30s. He said, "Aren't you going to eat the jackets?" We were in this prison camp, and I thought, "Hey, eat the jacket." He was from Missouri. The next day, the same thing. He was telling me that if you're going to have a frozen potato and don't want to eat the skin, that was your jacket on the potato, your potato jacket. And I couldn't have been a little slow in learning that the jacket was appealing on your potato.
How long were you on the front lines before you were captured?
Okay, when after we left Marseille, France, we were on army trucks. They would drive at night. We were approaching the front line, but we seldom saw any activity for 3 days. And then after that, we started seeing combat. So we learned how to dig the foxhole again. And the army, the German army, was zeroed in on our company very much on the 27th and the 28th. So we had medics of the whole battalion over helping my company B of the 103rd Infantry. That night, when the fire that live ammunition was so severe, we headed for a farmhouse and we went down into the basement of this farmhouse for protection. And as the night went on, we heard a rap on the door, and it was a German soldier. He said, "Come, come, nicht come, grenade." I had crawled back to the corner as far as I could get, as scared as I was. But somebody got up and opened the door going into the basement, and there were 65 of us in there, counting all the medics, so they had gotten in there with us. And we marched out of the basement, started down the road. But prior to that, a young German soldier approached me, and I had two live grenades pushed onto my combat jacket in the buttonhole, and aha! He saw those grenades and he jerked those off. I don't know whatever happened to them. And my rifle at first was disassembled in the basement. We were taught to disassemble your weapon, and that's what we had done. And the German civilians during the day then, you could see they were in an uproar. They almost demanded that the guards, instead of marching down the road, they just turn their weapons on us and live and shoot us. This was going all the way from till we got to Moosburg, Germany. When we got to Moosburg, Germany, that was where I was going to be for my prison camp life. As we were in Moosburg, they assigned us to barracks, and we had no stoves, no heat, and the bunks were stacked so that we had 12 men on a bunk. We had four on the bottom floor and four in the middle. And four on top, and there was woven wire stretched across those bunks with mattresses, with straw in the mattress, and that left a lot of fleas and no way to take our clothes off at night. We slept in our clothes, found out that if you take your boots off, your feet stayed warmer, but I had the same pair of socks, and I was not prepared for anything like this.
How long was that march?
We marched for like 21 days to get to Moosburg, Germany.
And you said that, was it at gunpoint the whole time?
Gunpoint, the civilians that we marched through, some of the cities, the windows are all boarded up and very few people in any of the towns. But what people were there, they would just soon have the guards shoot us as to march us through their towns until we got to Moosburg, Germany.
What happened in Moosburg then?
Moosburg, they assigned us to a barracks. There was a I don't know how many were there, but there were Polish, there was a French, there were Russians, Polish and French, and some Russians that had been there for years and years in that German prison. And they were even assigned guards as guards to guard us at night around this prison camp. They marched all night long, barbed wire fences, and with the police dogs, and they marched around this camp all night long. No, only perhaps just light guard duty in here in the United States. And then in the morning, it was a matter of And if they always said if we didn't get up, they'd turn that police dog loose, and they would get us up. But we had formation outside the barracks, just like you would in the American Army, kind of formation. And we off to work in Munich, Germany, 30 kilometers from Moosburg.
So the prison camp was in Moosburg, and I see here that it was prison camp Stalag 7A, Moosburg. So what you're telling me now is that you worked in you were prison workers in Munich.
Printer in Moosburg, and we worked in Munich.
Sure.
So
Okay.
we rode bus tires. They put us on bus tires to go into Munich. And then during the day, they would take the bus tires and move them way out of town because they didn't want them to get bombed. Because bus tires were our transportation to get back to camp. And then in the morning, we rode the bus tires. And being how I was a prisoner all December, January, and February, and March, it was cold, cold, cold weather. But the weather, the amount of snowfall and the conditions weren't really, I've seen worse in South Dakota. Fortunately, we had a very good winter. And then during the days in Munich, we were given shovels and wheelbarrows and spades to whatever the Americans had bombed. Some of the roads were couldn't get through the roads, so we'd have to shovel and clean out these roads, try and make people could move around a bit, trucks and so on. And we got Red Cross parcels. Sometimes there were six men on a bus, and before the war was over, it was 12 men on a bus of Red Cross parcels, which include sugar and cigarettes and Spam and candy bars and cheeses, different cheeses. So you can't imagine how we were so happy to get that box of Red Cross parcels, but you can't imagine how we would have fought just over a little piece of meat or a drop of cheese or something because we were that hungry. And when we first got captured, there was a German bread that looked like it was made out of sawdust. We thought, we'll never eat that bread. But I tell you, when you get hungry, you eat anything. And we started eating German bread. And when we got into Munich, the civilians there liked our American cigarettes so well, and they perhaps couldn't get cigarettes. So if you were told that already you had to go to the latrine, or if you had to go behind a tree, and the civilians would hide behind those trees, and they'd want to slip a slice of bread over to us for those cigarettes. And you know that sometimes you could get a loaf of bread for one cigarette, but first one in the morning, they were anxious to get cigarettes, we were anxious to get bread, so the price went up to maybe three cigarettes. And boy, our buddies thought, what are you doing paying three cigarettes for a loaf of bread? And toward the end of the day, then you could get a whole loaf of bread for one cigarette. So they were that hard to come by.
So there was a system there in place. How often did you receive those Red Cross parcels?
We had one parcel a week to start with. But as the war got on, the container and perhaps a larger number of prisoners, it was cut down, so maybe we only get one parcel every 2 weeks. But something else I want to mention is that during the day in Munich, there'd be an air raid siren blow, just like we have now when we have a tornado in the area. They blow the siren. During the day, when those sirens blew, can you imagine those German civilians, older people, they were all senior citizens, packing up anything that they thought was of value, and they'd head for an air raid shelter. Maybe the next day there wouldn't be any siren air raid warning. Maybe the next day you'd get air raid warning twice. Can you imagine Americans putting up with something like this in our city, that we had to pack up and go, and then pack up and go back to your shelter? And us prisoners were the last ones in. They didn't want us to get bombed either, but after the civilians got in, then we could get in the air raid shelters also. And those were all built just like our subways in New York. And that happened quite often.
I was going to say, how many times, say, in a week would there be an air raid siren
Probably sometimes 3 times a week, the air raid siren. Because who knows, the war was still going on, and Americans were using excessive amount of bombs. In fact, we'd get propaganda sheets from the Germans saying that they were winning the war. They wanted to tell us, let us prisoners, didn't want our morale to get real high. And they would send us literature indicating that we were losing the war. Actually, we were supposedly we were winning the war.
What
And
happened when you would receive that propaganda? How would you and your fellow prisoners react?
I guess that when our morale went way down, if we were having a good day and got back at night, and then some of the captains or major or what had high-ranking officers of the Germans would read this propaganda to us. And when Roosevelt died while I was in prison camp, we just thought, no, no, President Roosevelt's not dead. That's just propaganda. But actually, he was dead.
So you didn't all
panic.
And you didn't believe everything they told you. On some level, you knew it was propaganda.
We knew it was propaganda because we stuck up for, as much as we hated to leave our forces and join the Germans, but we knew the Americans were coming through. And then the week before we got liberated, you could hear the American artillery and American M1 rifle was firing at night. And then they came in on a Sunday morning, and General Patton, 3rd Army, liberated our camp.
How many men were in your camp?
The rumor was there were 25,000 when we got liberated.
25,000?
25,000 in this book, because we got liberated April 29th, and there were other service. If you were visit with other prisoners, they got liberated 27th and the 28th and the 26th. And I was on the 29th, and then the war was over, like May 7th or May 8th. So we were one of the last prison camps to be liberated. And General Patton came through 3 days after, this is Sunday morning. And Wednesday morning, he rode through, standing up in the Jeep, waving at us, waving at all the troops. We were standing out in the drive and waving at General Patton. Quite a sight. Tears came to our eyes Sunday morning when they put the American flag up over our prison camp. Mm.
Tell me more about life in the prison camp. During the day, you were all transported to Munich in boxcars, as you said, to work, to clean up from the Allied bombing raids. Mm-hmm. Did that continue for the whole time you were in the prison camp?
Yes. We didn't work Sunday. They never had to work on Sunday, but
really?
They were that religious part of it. In America, we had what the Geneva Convention. You know about the Geneva Convention, where many of the countries joined the Geneva Convention as to how to treat prisoners and what you could do and what you couldn't do. But Russia never joined the Geneva Convention. At no time Russia joined. So they did not get Red Cross parcels like we did. And if we had any derbies, so out in a garbage pile, the Russians would take their finger, index finger, and lift out those cans that we'd all thrown away with nothing in them. But they were letting those cans out. General Patton, and then the guards up in a watchtower fired back at our troops that Sunday morning. And we were all inside the barracks, nervous, of course, wondering what was going to happen. But actually, some of the guards were shot and fell off the tower that they were standing up there. They were that determined that they didn't want to let the Americans take over this prison camp. We stayed there, I see, April 29th, and I think it was way into June before we ever had transportation to get us over to Le Havre, France. It was to get organized. Find out who you are, papers to sign, 25,000 people and no records at all, who you are, what. So we had to start from scratch, and we slept in the same barracks, and then we went to the airport to fly out of Munich to fly to Le Havre, France. And I landed at Le Havre, France, and that was a little different there. We had prisoners, German prisoners were waiting on us, so we had no work detail at Le Havre, France. We were treated royally by the German guards.
Huh, that's kind of funny.
That was different.
And a turn of events, quite a difference from what you had gotten used to, I bet. So life in this camp, there were 25,000 men there, and it sounds like it was Americans and Russians and who else?
Polish.
Czechoslovakia,
French, and there's some other little country there, but they never were assigned the same area. We all had our own area to stay in.
How did you make it through the day-to-day drudgery of life as a POW? How did you make it through the day-to-day drudgery and
we were thankful that we were working. Because Susan, if you were laid in camp there all day with nothing to do, and would have been quarreling, and this way, we were tired, and we got back at night. It was already dark. Sometimes the train, we'd ride back in these boxcars, and sometimes they'd pause along the track for 45 minutes or an hour, waiting, and all of a sudden another train would go the other way. So it was just a matter of mixed up, and we wouldn't get back to camp until dark. So sleep in our own clothes, get up the next morning, go back to Munich again. One morning, when we were loading the bar tires, we started going the opposite direction and went to a city called Landshut. And Landshut had gotten bombed that night very heavy, and we went over there to help clean up the situation. It only went one day, but the load of grain, there were box cars loaded with wheat and so on, got bombed. There was wheat all over. And boy, we thought, oh, now we can get some wheat. But if you went over and did any wheat, you got shot. And we had a couple of guys that shot just going over to fill their pockets with wheat. And at 18, maybe it wasn't, or 19, it wasn't too hard for me to take orders. But for an elderly person that maybe had been out on his own occupation, and it was pretty hard to take orders from a German.
So at 19 years old, and you're in this prison camp for months, do you think being younger was helped you get through it?
I just think of all the married men that had families at home. They had a business, they had an occupation, maybe they run a furniture store, or maybe they were an employee of the city courthouse, and they were away from their duties, away from their jobs, and I hadn't really established any jobs yet. So there was an advantage then not to have that that overhang of, I hope my family's okay. I did worry about my brother and whether he was okay. But I did get a chance to send cards home. The Germans gave us 4 postcards, and they were censored before they were mailed out. But we weren't supposed to write anything about hardship. We were supposed to write about what a good time we were having. And my mom and dad got the cards. And there was the German writing on the card didn't mean anything to the folks. But we had a professor at college that could read German, so he let my folks know what the card was about. And mind you, mom kept writing to me pretty much all the time that I was a POW. Sent packages of food at Christmas time when I got captured around Thanksgiving, and she sent a Christmas parcel. That very parcel came back to Springfield, South Dakota, when the war was over.
Really?
They had a warehouse that must have stacked oodles and oodles and oodles of mail. And any mail that she had written to me came back to Springfield when the war was over.
Wow. So what got you through? What was the one thing, if there was one thing that that helped you know, or one thing that you could draw upon to know, I'm going to get through this and I'm going to get back home and see my folks and see my brother and my sister?
That maybe having faith in the Lord, having faith in God. Prayers that we would say together. We never did have church services in the city of Moosburg, but we did have some minister that would hold a slight service on Sunday morning, and we had our faith in prayer and with that. I wrote a poem.
Sure, you have a poem to share.
I thought, well, you know, the way the situation was that am I going to survive this prison camp or not? So that was kind of scary. So I thought, well, why don't I just compose a poem, and if maybe somebody finds this poem, they can send it to my folks. Starts off with, we were captured on the night of the 29th. They got us up way early. There wasn't a one of us in a hurry to be working under a jury. This is out in the front line. We climbed up in bastard and was it heck of riding. You freeze your toes and frost your nose, but we kept right on riding. We finally arrived in Munich. Our shovels and spades were waiting. With pockets full of soap and tea, we soon were busy trading. When the watches said 3:30, we threw the shovels away, climbed back up in the box cars and started back our way. When we got back to camp, we'd have a ration of soup that would be waiting. We easily put that away, put our bread in the boxes, and went to sleep on the hay. I dream of good old South Dakota, the land of the Sunshine State, hoping for the day when I'll be back and eating some hamburger steak. I'll be at home forevermore with a padlock on my door and all my dollars to the Red Cross and the heck with all the draft boards. That was a poem that I had written in camp. And to close this out, then, the little memory that I have here, and I think the public will be aware of it, that we need to think about our our faithful flag, and nowadays that we're at war, wondering what's going to happen. So here's it's just a piece of cloth. That is all it is, just a piece of cloth. But when a little breeze comes along, it stirs, comes to life, flutters, and snaps in the wind, all red, white, and blue. And then you realize that no other piece of cloth could be like this. It has your whole life wrapped up in it, the meals you eat, the time you spend with your family, the kind of things your boy or girl learn in school, the strange and the wonderful thoughts you get in church on Sunday morning. Those stars, they make you just as free as the stars in the wide, deep night. And those stripes, they are the bars of blood to any dictator who would try to change this way of life. It's just a piece of cloth, that is all, until you put your soul into it and give it meaning. Then it is a symbol of liberty, decency, and fair dealing with everyone. It is just a piece of cloth until we breathe life into it. Until we make it stand for everything we believe in and refuse to live without it. This is something I always remember as a part of my time in the service. And I think it had a lot of good bearing about this little pretty flag. Landed in June 4th in New York City. On June 9th, I was back in Springfield.
How did that feel when you returned to Springfield?
Well, in a town, in a small city like Springfield, Saturday night was always a big night. So I got back into Springfield Saturday night, so it was time on cloud. Took me a while to get down off of cloud nine.
I bet. Charles, I'm wondering if you've thought about over the years how the war changed you, or what aspects of your war experience have stayed with you all this time.
I tell you, Susan, when you put that army gear on and you hold your right hand, get sworn into the service, it just sends shivers up and down your spine. You just feel like you're number one. And I will always feel that way, that when I went to serve my country, and when I got home I joined the National Guard, because I think that every bit of public relations and military courtesy that we don't have in our homes anymore. We don't have a lot of respect because the parents are busy and don't have time to spend with the children. But I feel like I was raised at a good time, and I think Tom Brokaw, when he wrote the story about, what was the word?
The Greatest Generation.
The Greatest Generation. I think Tom Brokaw hit the nail on the head.
How do you think your war experience changed you?
I think it did something about caring for your buddy and the person around beside you, even though you don't know them. You have to show some respect. And when we came by the Statue of Liberty in New York on the way home, that's a lot of pride and joy that you take, and we're able to live in America and do the things that we do. And oh God, our Father, it's just wonderful.
Okay, anything else you'd like to share with me, Charles?
I think I've talked too long, Susan, but if I've done of any good for you, I appreciate this opportunity to express my feelings. And life in the service, when you're on the telephone, they say over and out.
Well, thank you, Charles, for your service to our country.